Hi, I'm Art Kleiner, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Strategy and Business. In this podcast, we focus on a particular type of high-potential talent, people who turn ideas into major new enterprises. Some of them are better known as self-made billionaires. In the course of making their fortunes, they often overcome challenges that overwhelm other business leaders, and they make it all look easy. But there's also something they can't do. They need people around them who can perform in the conventional way. That's the secret message of high potential leadership. You need both producers and performers on your team. 3 years ago, John Sfiocla and Mitch Cohen set out to conduct the first systematic study of self-made billionaires, people who didn't inherit enormous wealth, but who created it. John is the director of global thought leadership at PwC, and Mitch is a PwC vice chairman. Their goal was to find out how these extreme entrepreneurs create and grow their businesses and what established companies can learn from them. You'll hear S&B contributing writer Laura Starita, who worked with John and Mitch on their book, The Self-Made Billionaire Effect, talk in depth with them about high potential talent, what it is, and how to get the most from it. They'll also discuss some of the myths and the realities of the self-made billionaire effect.
In their book, John and Mitch make the case that the source of self-made billionaire success lies in five habits of mind that allow these people to act as what they call producers. One of the five habits deals with risk. John and Mitch argue that self-made billionaires are not taking bigger risks than the average corporate executive. Mitch, start us off. The idea of an entrepreneur as a risk taker is so strong, it's really hard to believe that these people were not taking more risks. But what did you see?
What we saw was that they had a relative view of risk, that they were aware of what could go wrong, the risks of failure, but they balanced that with the risk of missing out on a large opportunity. And they looked at those two things together in making their decision whether to pursue something or not.
What was fascinating about it, Laura, too, was the notion that their curiosity really drove a search for value. So you take a guy like Glenn Taylor, who runs Taylor Industries. He's working in a print shop in his 20s, and he's looking at all the different products that his boss was making at the time, and he realizes they're only making money on wedding invitations. And he thinks, wow, if we actually made a product out of this, we can make a fortune, and we could sell all the other things around it, like the balloons and the napkins, something as simple as that. So there's a hugely mature industry. And he doesn't look at this, you know, innovation as a set of risks. He looks at it as a potential set of opportunities that can create great value.
Mitch, what about you? What are some of the examples of use that you saw of self-made billionaires taking risks that others would not have taken because they had the wrong idea about what was really at stake there?
One of the interesting interviews that we did was with Stephen Ross, and who's a big real estate developer. And Stephen Ross was a person who worked with us as a tax manager, moved to New York, was fired twice after he made the leap into the financial services industry, then staked out his claim in real estate. And he developed the Columbus Circle, which if you've been in New York is a big development where the Time Warner Center is, there's shops, there's apartments. And he faced that corner, which was really not the best of neighborhoods when he looked at it, and had a vision of what could be. Took on a lot of debt, put a lot of personal debt, and got it done. And yes, there was a lot of risk as to what could go wrong, but he saw the real potential in what could go right in what is now one of the most thriving and important areas of the city.
Yeah, and you look at what Steve's doing right now, he's got $500 million already in to Hudson Yards on the Hudson side of the Manhattan. And he has to put in that much concrete before he can even start building. But when he was taking us through the model, it was amazing because he was talking about all the benefits that were happening. He was picking up each of the little buildings in the model and saying, you know, this is the anchor tenant here and this is the anchor tenant here. He really thought from a possibility lens back.
So, I mean, someone like Stephen Ross is a great example, not only because you see how much he has to put in before any of the results start to become evident. There's a huge amount of investment that goes into the development industry, but a lot of industries. There's a lot of time and ideas.
Laura, one of the interesting things about that is that one of the myths that we saw that's out there is that these, you know, people make billions very, very quickly, and you're raising the issue that these things do take a fair amount of time. on average, these ideas to get to a mature state to create $1 billion of value were over 10 years. And these people had the patience to wait that out. And that's something we don't often see in corporate America.
Talk a little more about those contrasts, because hand in hand with that kind of a time frame and hand in hand with that kind of sometimes initial investment, there are going to be missteps and failures along the way. How are these people viewing their experiences with failure compared to what you see in a more common corporate American experience?
One of the things that we saw was that they did fail in many cases. Many didn't finish school. Some went bankrupt. Some had startups that didn't go well. They got fired, all those kinds of things. And I would say they didn't let it define them as to who they were. In fact, in certain cases, these people knew going in that there was a high chance of failure. One of the interviews we did was with Steve Case, who started AOL. And when he left Pepsi, he went to a startup. And he told us when we met with him that he knew going there was a chance this wouldn't go well, and it was going to take a lot to get a startup turned around. And he said he learned a lot, even though it did go bust, from dealing with managing cash flow, managing people in a bootstrap kind of business where times were tough. And he took that mentality to his next venture, which was AOL.
Yeah, and there are lots of times that they have the patience to hang in there. And in the book we talk about patient urgency. It's really about the belief in themselves, even though a lot of people may or may not believe in them. And also the willingness to have real failures. So you take a guy like Chip Wilson behind Lululemon. His first company, he caught the surfing wave and was the first one to do the baggy pant surf, pants. And he's a big guy, and as he said, the bathing suits at the time, you could read a dime in his pocket kind of bathing suits. But then he missed. He missed on a couple of other trends before he hit on the yoga trend. But it didn't faze him. It's really about learning and curiosity. And also, I think I'm starting to believe, and I forget which of our billionaires mentioned it, but the notion that failure is not succeeding. If you try something and you don't make it, you don't succeed. Failing is when you see a real opportunity that you really believe is real and you don't try to go after that opportunity. That's a real failure.
One of the things that we saw time and time again was that, you mentioned Chip Wilson. To him, some of these trends were so clear, he just knew it was a matter of time before it would happen. He thought that with yoga clothing, he thought that with the surfing industry, and you just have to wait it out and have the patience. Steve Case thought it was so clear. Stephen Ross thought it was so clear that of course you're gonna build something. It's one of the best pieces of real estate in all of New York, overlooking the river and the park. And I think these folks have that clarity in their vision as to what could be, and then they have the patience to wait it out and continue to drive in that direction.
Mitch and I were at the Tribeca Anti-Summit Summit, and they had the founder of Airbnb there, and it was funny when he accepted an innovation award, and he said, all my friends say, oh, this is completely obvious. And he said, except, of course, when I was starting the company, everybody said to me, who would ever do that? And then as soon as it was up and running, he's like, oh, it's completely obvious. And I think that notion of these billionaires understand that, gee, when they're early on, everybody's going to disagree. And then once it's done, it's really obvious to everyone.
Right. We're sitting here recording this in New York City, and it's almost impossible to walk a block without confronting, dozens sometimes brands that are associated with some of these self-made billionaires. So if you're over at Hudson Yards, obviously Stephen Ross is all over that, and if you're up at Columbus Circle, but if every corner has a Starbucks, almost literally, and you see advertisement for Spanx, there's advertising for Carnival Cruise Lines, there's Aldi Supermarkets, there's just all of these examples. But these people are so obviously outliers. And Mitch, you have been working with companies for 33 years on the broad spectrum from amazingly successful to companies that are struggling. What lessons for risk do you think you can communicate to companies who maybe are acting with a more traditional approach of caution?
Well, I think a big part of that with companies, I'm not being critical of the companies, it's just a fact that many individuals and companies themselves get measured on a relatively short-term basis. They get measured quarter to quarter. You pick up a newspaper every quarter and you read about, did you make earnings by a penny? Did you miss earnings by a penny? You hear of activists coming after companies because they think they could squeeze a little bit more out of various companies. And getting that balance right between the long term and short term is very, very difficult, and that's something companies can learn from that. Put CEOs in a very, very difficult spot, though, because the facts are that you can make a stock move in the short term by taking some short-term actions to take out costs, to not invest in the business long term. And that's why many of these companies grew out of private enterprises that didn't have the same day-to-day kinds of pressures. They put pressure on themselves, they may have had cash flow pressures, but they were able to differentiate themselves and continually build the business at the appropriate pace that the market demanded.
I think there's another dimension too, which is a dimension of diversity. And I know at our firm, we worry a lot about diversity along all the dimensions that are important, you know, along, you know, race, lifestyle, gender, and so forth. But Mitch and I are starting to come to believe that there's also a diversity of thinking that companies, whether they mean to or not, basically get people in kind of one mode of thinking. And you really have to have some support or even some just, you know, personal chutzpah to think differently. You know, the old Apple, you know, thing, think different. There's a lot in there, or for that matter, Watson Senior around IBM, where he had think. That's actually not that easy to do. For example, Mitch and I, just as we're getting ready for this recording today, we're talking about the fact that, you know, Mitch was talking to an entrepreneur who has a patent for a new security, and Mitch showed it to a couple of experts in the financial services industry, and their first reaction was, there's nothing new there. I would be willing to bet they didn't even read it, because they're so, this cognitive strain of trying to think differently is not something that corporations support or that people are used to doing in lots of roles.
So on that subject, there's a quote from the computer pioneer Howard Aiken, who's famous for saying that innovators shouldn't worry about people stealing their ideas, because if they're truly new, they're going to have to ram them down people's throats. And I find that particularly interesting, because it seems like these people, these self-made billionaires themselves, have to carry a lot of personal risk and then translate the activity, you know, these five habits of mind, into the corporation. People with different modes of thinking have to carry a lot of personal risk in order to ram ideas into the organization. How do people get treated in these environments?
I think it's really true that when you're doing something new, that is the challenge. It's how do you get people to believe in it? And it's almost binary. People completely don't believe and think it's totally stupid till they see it in success, and then it was always there. And that, when you think about it from the point of view of the innovator, the producer, you have to have a lot of courage, and you also need a set of expertise and people that you are willing to talk to really get there. Because during that time period where it's completely unobvious to everybody, compared to when it's successful in the marketplace, that's the hardest thing.
Yeah, I'd add that what we see in corporate America very often, when people are trying to sell an idea, they're trying to please their boss. They're trying to please the next layer up in an organization. These folks, they're obsessed with pleasing the ultimate customer. That's what they wake up in the morning thinking about. And they remain focused on that, and that's why they're able to differentiate. And they recognize that the customer may not know what they actually need. You know, Steve Jobs, there's been a lot written about that. I mean, you look at something like Uber. You know, the customer couldn't imagine that you could, you know, use your iPhone, if you will, to get a taxi in the rain in New York City. Yet, I'm sure that idea was out there with other people, and it was a tough sell for people. So I think it's, do you focus on your organization or do you focus on the ultimate customer? Long-term, great value comes from focusing on the customer and a customer's needs.
Yeah, you take a look at somebody like Sarah Blakely from Spanx. You know, when she started that, she basically, you know, cut the feet off a set of pantyhose so that she wouldn't have a panty line when she was wearing her favorite white denim pants. And she had to go to over 100 manufacturers, and it was only when the manufacturer that she had described it to was home having dinner with his wife and two daughters, And he described the product, and they said, wow, we would totally buy that. That's what, he was the first manufacturer then manufactured for her. And she persevered with that, and then she ran into some business difficulty before she got a performer to work with her. She was really the producer. And then she got herself onto Oprah Winfrey, and the rest, as they say, is history. But it's that perseverance and that ability to take no. In a related sense, one of the things that we found is that 72%, I forget, Mitch, the exact percentage, but the number of folks who came from sales and from marketing who became billionaires. And we think that's got two hunks. One hunk is the product or service itself focusing on the customers, Mitch was talking about. The other is they have the genius to package that thing up into what we call an investable proposition. So they can go to anybody who's got the resources and, you know, and say, okay, well, this is something you really ought to invest in. And what we see a lot in corporations is that people feel like they don't have a responsibility for that second innovation. They've got an idea, but they don't think it's on them to pitch it in a way that will get the resources. They think the company's supposed to come to them. And we just don't see that happening. The real producers understand it's a two-step process.
Mitch, what is a producer?
We have defined a producer as somebody who has the ability to bring together diverse people and resources to create a new product, service, and or business model. Not only do they possess good judgment, but they have imaginative vision. And they can see the next billion-dollar idea and work through all of the challenges of execution to actually make it real and bring it to fruition.
Are there a majority of producers in business? How common are they?
You know, I don't know the answer to, people ask us about the number, how many producers are there. And the way John and I have looked at this is it's a bit of a continuum. And at one end are extreme performers, at one end are extreme producers, and that's really the population we studied. But there's people all along that continuum. Like most populations, most of them sit somewhere in the middle. And a lot of what we've talked about is how you move certain people up that continuum, if you will, and identify potential outliers who may be extreme producers that may be in your organization.
Another thing we see in these producers is that they develop a vector of confidence. So you take a guy like Eli Broad, and he starts out, he's an accountant, he has an idea for building new homes that if he has no basement and he only has a lean-to instead of a car cover instead of a garage, he can build and price those homes for the same price at the time as what renting an apartment costs. And he figured, hey, if I can give it to the same price as renting an apartment, somebody will buy a home, why not? And so, but he also had a fallback. He was an accountant. He said, look, if I fail at this, I can always go back and be an accountant. And he built these things on with his uncle. He's the K part of KB Homes. And then they built a dozen, sold them in a weekend. And that began a whole progression of more and more scale, more and more capability, more and more speed, and so forth. Then he also picked his head up, and he looked over, and he said, boy, these people are in my homes. They're also going to need to buy retirement products because Social Security is not going to take care of everything they need. So he goes out, and he buys an insurance company, and he turns it into SunAmerica, and then builds beautiful annuity products that people like. And then, with his fortune and his philanthropy, he decides to do even more out there things. So he funds the Broad Institute outside of MIT, where Eric Lander helped decode the human genome. And so, you know, that progression of confidence, capability, resources, and so forth. And we think that that has a lot to do with how people move across, you know, the spectrum. And, you know, it's true in human development in general.
John, I think it's well said. Once you learn to do something, you gain more confidence. It becomes easier to do it the next time. And one of the things we learned from these people is that most of them were not one-hit wonders. Most of them developed multiple businesses, maybe not at the scale of Eli Broad, but they were able to have other successful businesses. And I think having the confidence that you could do it once enables you to do it a second time. But I will say, before they got to their billion-dollar idea, they had other successes in other areas, maybe just a smaller scale, smaller businesses, success in when they were in college doing something. So I think that's one of the things that we look for now and encourage companies to look for in their own businesses, those people who have those small wins, who may have the potential that they may not even know they have themselves until they're provided with that opportunity.
Eli Broad is one of the only self-made billionaires on the Forbes list who has created two separate billion-dollar companies, which gets at this issue of luck that I think becomes one of the explanations that people have for how these people who have these producers' habits of mind, how these people got to be billionaires. Mustn't there also be hundreds, millions, thousands of others who have these habits, but they just weren't lucky?
I mean, luck always plays a role, and you can be lucky or unlucky, but it's rare that luck hits serially. And when you look at the way that these people look at problems, it's really not, I think, having anything to do with luck. So you look at somebody like a Mark Cuban. He comes along and he's working at a TV repair place, and he says to the repair guy, you know, we could do computer implementation, right? We could do networking. Personal computers just coming out, and his boss said, I'm not interested in doing that. You're crazy. So he leaves and he starts his own company, sells that. Then he's looking at the internet, you know, he's programming, he's looking at, you know, what's happening with consumer stuff, and he comes up with broadcast.com because he's a sports fan. Says, why can't I stream, you know, Indiana basketball over the internet? Does that. Sells it to Yahoo for a couple $1 billion. And, you know, people say he was lucky to get that price. I don't really think he was, because if you look at what he saw at the time, and he saw the whole, what's in the business called over-the-top, you know, content and radio and video and so forth, what we now think of as YouTube, Netflix, Spotify. That was all in broadcast.com. Now, due to the internet downturn, Yahoo did not invest heavily behind that at the time, or maybe it was a little early, but I don't think that was lucky. Then you look at what he did at the Mavericks. I mean, he really changed the nature of sports management, both in terms of how the relationship with the fans, how he promoted the team, his role, his activist role, the whole routine. And now he's even developing what he calls human performance capabilities. So they fired their strength and conditioning trainer. They're doing metabolic, genetic, you know, intensive testing and, you know, nutritional and so forth. And he thinks that's the leading edge of personalized medicine. You look at that, you say, I'm sorry, that's not luck. That's the way you look at problems and opportunities.
When I go back to that, these ideas took 10 years to bring to fruition. A 10-year period's a long time. And you're going to have some good luck along the way, and you're going to have some bad luck along the way. I think what differentiates these folks is that they persevere through the bad times. They take advantage of the good luck that may be along the way, and they have that patience to see it all the way through. So I think when you're dealing with periods that are 10 years long, it's not a flip of a coin. It's not a lottery ticket. There's a lot that has to fall into place, and a lot of that you have to make it fall into place.
Talking about bad luck.
Yes.
Mentioning Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban, in one of his earlier businesses, had a secretary who defrauded the company for $50,000 or something. She was just, you know, canceling out the name of a client or of a payee on the checks and then writing her own name in and cashing these checks and basically wiped the company dry. They had to start from scratch. And a number of years after that, then his house burned down, I believe, and lost everything that he owned. So the man did not have perfect luck, clearly, in that scenario. But he was also on his own and able to, of his own devices, kind of pull up his bootstraps and say, okay, we have to rebuild from here. Very often inside of a corporate environment, you're sort of relying on your boss to say, yes, you can carry on. Is there shame that you sort of have to ask permission to carry on after you've had a bit of a stumble or even an outright failure? Unlike Mark Cuban, who just of his own volition was able to decide, okay, we're going to carry on. What can companies do to give people permission to try and maybe decrease that tendency towards shaming or that attitude towards, oh, you got lucky or you didn't get lucky?
Could I mince words with you for a minute? When you said give people permission to try, I think that's the wrong mindset.
Yeah.
I think it's encourage people to take the accountability to try, which I think is different. And it's exactly a change in attitude, which is it's not about waiting until you are given permission. It's about saying, look, I'm a business professional, and I have an accountability to create value for this organization, and I need to take accountability for some of the ways that I should ask for resources, grow the business, come up with new capabilities. And if I get resistance to that, it's on me to think of new ways to tell the story, to get colleagues who will support me, to have access to resources, to help people see the light. And so I think that this is, to me, this is one of the real problems with our attitudes towards innovation in large organizations. I don't think large organizations talk enough about the role of leaders is not to just give permissions, but to encourage the independence and to listen to folks who are independent within the organization.
You're really talking about a mindset of responsibility that's different from what I think many of us are taught to do as employees. I think as employees, we have a job description, and I am supposed to do X, Y, and Z, and I stay within that. A and B and C are not on my job description, so I can't do that. And I think, John, what you're saying is, no, if there's value in A, B, and C, it's your part of having a responsibility to the company you work for is figuring out a way to make A, B, and C part of what you do in order to add value.
Exactly. And it's also the job of leadership that if you have middle managers who are threatened by that, you need to move those middle managers out of the way, because they're the ones who are training the organization to not look for value.
But let me be really clear. What John and I have told a number of companies as we've discussed this issue is that sounds great, and that's what real leaders need to do, but companies aren't doing it, and they're not encouraging it, and they're not developing the right kind of leaders, and they're not asking. And I will tell you, in most cases, that starts at the top. When people have asked us what to do, how to create that environment, it starts with a CEO and their immediate team and what kind of demands he or she is placing on that team to develop ideas, to bring ideas, to discuss failure, to do those kinds of things. If it doesn't start at that level, I don't think you have a chance of getting that done deep in the organization, because people are going to look up and say, how did those people get to that level? Did they do that by taking chances? Did they get there by doing something beyond what the job description says?
You know, one of the great things about working on this with Mitch, it's really, from a certain perspective, the celebration of the individual, that when you think about what we're talking about are really duos, right? Producer-performer duos. By and large, performers are folks who know how to optimize an existing business model. What a lot of people don't realize is that they are born into a business model and somebody else designed it, whether it's years ago, decades ago, or even centuries ago. Or what we saw in our research was this idea of a leadership partnership. So you have producer-performer pairs, and we were able to actually identify in a full 60% of the cases an actual duo, whether it's Mike Bloomberg and Tom Segunda, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, Bill Gates and Paul Allen. You have these duos. I mean, heck, think about the Rolling Stones. I don't know if you've listened to either Mick Jagger's solo albums or Keith Richards' solo albums, but they're both awful. Together, they're magic. We'll often go into a setting and say, gee, here's how the attributes of leadership you need to look for. And the thing Mitch and I will hear back is, okay, tell us the process. And it's like, well, yeah, you need a little bit of process, but this is about picking duos that know what they're doing. And one of the things that we hack around with, but really kind of believe, is that it's not about getting the perfect process. And when you see someone who's a duo that's delivered before, give them more latitude, give them more capability. Don't try to figure out a process to make that work. Bet on the people.
This whole concept of duos, I think if there's a group of people who might be getting it right, it might be in the tech sector in the West Coast, where you see venture capital has figured out that you may have some young folks coming out of those schools and they have great ideas and they want to, you know, jump in and do some things. But they need to be paired up with the term that they often use on the West Coast is adult supervision. And pairing those kinds of people up with the right kind of people is what becomes very, very powerful. And I think that's a sector that seems to be getting it. But we think there's a lot more that could be done in a lot of other sectors.
Yes, and one of the important things there too is that the adult supervision is working for the kids. So Sheryl Sandberg is working for Mark Zuckerberg, not the other way around. And Eric Schmidt was working for Brendan Page, not the other way around. Because we think that if you do stick a performer in too early, that you have a real chance of kind of squishing down the potential space.
I wanted us to circle back to a subject, which is shame.
Shame.
Sarah Blakely, I think you used the example that she tried to get 100 different manufacturers to make this flagship product of hers before someone finally took it on. So these are like constant mini failures of people saying no, no, no. There's also failures where people lose $1 million of investment, maybe more than $1 million of investment. What do companies do to people who have ideas that work in conflict with the culture and movement of the organization? And how do we work as organizations to get rid of this culture of shaming that we inadvertently develop?
Well, I think that in large human organizations, whether corporations or religious organizations or universities where I used to work for a while, one of the ways that power gets exercised at the top is through shame. And I think there's what you might call kind of honest shame, and then you have kind of more manipulative shame. So the honest shame part is when people aren't used to thinking of new ideas and they're busy working hard to try to get everybody aligned in a particular direction, and, you know, gee, they hear all kinds of noise and everything, which is, you know, what it's like to be a CEO or, you know, a senior executive. You know, you're getting attacked, pulled at, lots of people want to do lots of things. You're trying to stay on message, and it's been shown time and time again that better performing organizations have a clear vision of what you're doing and how what each of your employees are doing relates to what you're doing and how they get measured and so forth. So that's a full-time job to keep people on message. And so when somebody comes along like a producer or a producer performer pair and says, look, here's a whole new way to think about things. You know, your day job is to try to keep everything going in the right direction. And all of a sudden there's this person who's creating noise. And if they're credible, my goodness, that even creates more noise because people start saying, oh, well, you know. And I think that it's incumbent upon the leader to make space for that. But some of them are just too busy or get, you know, are sloppy about it or whatever. And I think that's kind of honest shaming. So you kind of shame that idea. It's like, oh, well, let's stay on course. And there are lots of, anybody who's on the top of an organization knows how to shame other people in front of other people in a meeting, right? That's just part of how you get there, right? Then I think there's dishonest shaming. And dishonest shaming is about going after power even if you think the idea is right. And I think that there's some of that that goes on as well. It's like, oh boy, I rode this particular idea and so forth to the position I'm in. If that person is right, wow, that undermines my power base. And I better figure out how to take, you know, basically undermine that idea. And because there's so much effort in organizations to go in this one direction, the tools that you have to shame someone, it's like, oh, do we really have that competency? You know, so-and-so tried that before. Gee, that's not practical. That's a great dreamy kind of thing. Even if the person has very specific examples, they will start describing it in abstract terms, unpractical. Yes, I hear you, but I'm really interested in the bottom line. And this is a whole language system to use. So I think shame inside large corporations has an honest face and a dishonest face. But those at top of organizations know how to wield it very powerfully.
I think if you couple shame with what we talked about with risk earlier, you put those two things together and you could really kill a lot of great ideas. I'm very sympathetic to what goes on with companies that they get to a certain point, they grow, they may have a great idea, they may grow it, and then all of a sudden you start saying, wow, now I really have something to lose. With all due respect to Mark Cuban, at the beginning, you know, he had a secretary who could take $50,000 from him. Okay, nobody likes to lose $50,000, but not the end of the world. Then when you grow a $1 billion company, boy, it starts looking very, very differently as to what you can lose. So you get this pressure going the other way. And that's why you see so many companies that have difficulty maintaining that same kind of enthusiasm and where's the next idea. And that's why you've seen so many CEOs, founders grow companies and then get kicked out because they're ready to continue on that journey, and others in the company want to sort of protect the base, if you will, and what we've developed. Steve Jobs famously got thrown out of Apple, and it's a long list of founders who either got kicked out or left on their own and had to come back, but there is a true pattern there.